What's up? It's Marcus. And just a quick note, Create and Orchestrate is live. You can get it today at Amazon, and for a very short period of time, it is available for 99 cents on the Kindle. So that is a complete steal. Go grab it today if you haven't already. And also, I'm selling signed copies as well as commemorative t-shirts for the launch at my own e-commerce store, creativepower.co. That's creativepower.co. So go get it today. And now for the episode of Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.
This is Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.
Like, you got to do the work. You got to show up and just do the work.
What's good? What's good? Happy Wednesday. Another episode of Marcus Whitney Live. And I've got a really, really good friend. I would call him a brother for sure. This is a dude who, look, I'll just put it out there like this. You know, when you are at these tech conferences and these events and these entrepreneurial events, and you are a black person, you are often one of the only black people there. Okay. And, man, we, you know, sometimes people wonder, like, why do y'all like always congregate together? You know what I'm saying?
Right,
and
right,
it's like,
right.
Sometimes it's just 'cause like, it feels nice to know you're not alone. So that's like one dynamic. Another dynamic is the idea of, you know, mentors in the space. And I have a lot of peer mentors, but I don't have that many that like are just that much more experienced, that much more accomplished. And this dude fits right in that pocket for me. And you know, every time I call him for anything I need, he's always there. So I had to get him on the show and just introduce him to my universe. So without further ado, my man, Marquise Stillwell. Marquise, what's up, brother?
What's happening, Marcus, my brother? Great to be here. Thank you for being here with you. Thanks for this platform. And it's a privilege to be able to connect with you.
Yeah, so, man.
Looking forward to digging in.
Yeah, man. It's good to have you here. So look, man, let's just kind of start with your background and how you became the founder of OpenBox.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a difficult thing. I'm sure you know you get asked this all the time. And for me, I feel like I've always been doing what I'm doing right now. It just took me a while to get it to this incarnation of what you see. But you know, I was born, you know, I'm a Midwestern kid, born in Ohio, and always had a hustle, always entrepreneur, whether it was selling lemonade on a corner. I had my own paper route. I washed cars. I cleaned, you know, shined shoes. And I did whatever it took just to make my hustle. And so I was always an entrepreneur. I was always an activist in the community. When things went wrong, we, you know, we were always lacing up our boots and marching and caring and sharing and loving. And I always loved to solve problems. And, you know, my uncles and grandparents worked in steel mill and auto plants. And, you know, I grew up at a time when something broke, you fixed it, right? Your TV broke, you fixed it, right? You had an antenna, mm-hmm. You know how to change a tire.
Yep.
I know how to change oil. And so for me, being a designer and what I'm calling a designer of someone who goes out and solves problems is just something that's always been in my DNA. And what you see now in the form of open box design and the other things that I'm touching is just a mature incarnation of what I've always been doing. And I've kind of caught up with the word design, but I feel like my grandparents and just being a person of color, a person that doesn't always have all the means to, you know, push buttons, that you have to make it happen. And if it's so, then, you know, if it's up to me, if it is to be, it's up to me, as, you know, a lot of people would say. And that's how I grew up. And the design as a framework is a beautiful framework that allows me to bring in all the community aspects, all the entrepreneurial aspects of the type of things that I love to do.
So what was it like for you to establish a design firm? Like, you know, were you looking out there and you just sort of knew that you wanted to do, like for me, design was something that came along later. I was a technologist, you know, I knew about entrepreneurship. I knew about right. graphic design, but design as this broader overarching thing that influences everything that we touch and see, that was a concept that came to me much later in my career. You know, when did the concept of design as the foundation hit you?
Yeah. Yeah. for me, it was in solving a problem. So about 20 years ago, some friends of mine, we were solving a problem where you would, you know, you go skiing, you'd break your arm and you needed to put a cast on and then you needed to take a shower. So you needed to cover that cast. And so a friend kept breaking his arm and he would use garbage bags to cover his arm to take a shower. And so this is like late 90s, early 2000s. And so he came to myself and a few of our partners and we started to develop this product. And we'd go out to Brooklyn. I live in Manhattan right now. We go out to Brooklyn and, you know, all the different fabrication and manufacturing companies out there. And so we'd go there and then we'd go up to Vail in Colorado to the medical center and work with the doctors there because a lot of skiers would break their arms. And so IDO had an office in Boulder, Colorado. And I was out in Denver and I was going to graduate school and I talked my way into IDO. And so this was 20 years ago when they were still very much an industrial design firm. Design was obviously a part of it, but this idea of design thinking was still early. And so I kind of grew up with this aspect of where we ended up now with design thinking, which was very different, say 20 years ago. But I was always in the pursuit of solving problems and knew that I needed a framework in order to solve a lot of the challenges that I had. And it just stuck with me, what I learned when I met with them at that office.
So you, you know, we've collaborated a couple times as you've come down for the Help Further events that we've thrown.
Absolutely.
But one thing that I love about you is you model something for me that has always sort of felt natural, which is unboundedness in terms of, you know, where you allow yourself to get involved. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Where you take your talents. It's like whenever we have a conversation, you know, it's very, very open-ended. You know what I'm saying? Like you don't have these strong parameters or guardrails in terms of what it needs to look like in order for you to get engaged with it, which I just love. You know, talk a little bit about the work that you do at like the city level. You know, I find that to be fascinating work and you do it around the world. So it's not even just like American cities, right? You know, talk about that a little bit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so for us at Open Box, it's all about designing for better urban living. And I would argue that urban living is changing faster than technology. Right. You think about your iPhone, that's only going to change, you know, a margin of maybe 5 or 10%. There's not an extraordinarily new app that's going to change anything until we get to a place where it's just like a hologram or something.
Right.
Right. It's not. And so, but when you get off a subway or you get out of your car, you go to another neighbor, you go, whoa, where am I? A place where I used to call home has now changed. Mm. And so like for you, Marcus, you come back to Brooklyn, you go to your old neighborhood and you're like, whoa, where am I? And it's a visceral feeling of, I don't know who I am because I don't know where I am.
Can I just stop you there? Because I just want to validate what you're saying. The last time I was in New York, I was there for my man's birthday party. We were in downtown Brooklyn. And I looked up and I saw skyscrapers in downtown Brooklyn.
Right.
And that was completely disorienting.
Right.
Completely.
Yes.
I was like, I literally don't know where I am.
That's right. Like literally, you're like, okay, which way do I walk to get to where I know I used to be?
I grew up here and I don't know where I am. Yes.
That's right. And the same thing in Nashville. I mean, I was just there a few weeks ago and I was down at the Gulch and I'm like, where is the whole, I used to stay at this hotel called the 404, I believe.
Yeah, 404, yep.
It's like buried underneath these big buildings now. You know, and so I kept driving in a big circle because I couldn't find where it was.
Yeah, right.
And so it's moments like that that are changing quickly and our ability to leverage design to help cities and communities and people find themselves, mm-hmm. right? And that at the end of the day is what's important for the work that we do is making sure that when you walk down the street, you can see yourself. And when you think about, you know, there's this big, ginormous word that we talk about all the time, gentrification. But for me, when you boil it down, basically what people are saying is that I'm tired of losing myself in the place I call home and not having the right to see me, not having the right to be able to walk into a store and be welcomed, not having the right to go to the school and feel like I belong, feel like I can afford to be able to live here anymore. That's really what people are screaming and yelling about. And for us, working with cities and communities in different neighborhoods to really support that is what's important for us.
So we're living in a pandemic, and we're seeing more changes to the urban landscape. We're seeing different migration patterns starting to emerge. What have you learned over the last 6 months is the role of design in an era such as this?
I think the power of the work that we do, if it's done well, because there is bad design as well, if it's done well, is to empower individuals to be more adaptive and in making sure that they can adapt to the changing environment. And so, for instance, we're all adapting to working more remotely now.
Yep.
We've had to get used to doing remote research on our side. So what does remote research mean for still trying to engage with our clients and still trying to engage with who they're supporting, but building trust, right? And so this idea of also designing for trust within this ability to be adaptive is really, from a technical standpoint, what we're driving on. And that's something that I've really seen. And some people know how to do it, some people don't. It's hard to create a rapport with someone very quickly over Zoom.
It's hard.
It's really hard.
It's hard.
And you can't hide behind a deck or PowerPoint or whatever you have. You're right there, you're raw, you're in your home. you're being seen.
Yes.
In a totally different way.
Yeah. Totally. With your kids and your pets and
exactly. Everything.
Your leaky faucet, the whole deal, right?
The whole deal. It's like here I am.
Yeah.
And I feel like that what I'm seeing over the last couple of weeks are people really struggling with adapting to the lack of structure as well, right? The lack of routine. Like you and I, we're always managing our own personal time.
Right.
So
that hasn't been that hard.
Exactly. Every day is a different day and it's always been a different day for us.
That's right.
Some people don't, they need that structure. They need to get in their car, get in the subway, grab the coffee, walk up to the office, have the routine. And when you don't have that, you start to lose yourself. And I think a lot of people, the mental health issues that are happening right now are pretty sad, and you're seeing a breaking point for a lot of people.
One of the things that I love about the way that you work, the how to it, right, is that it is very much a complete reflection of who you are as a person. So you would tell me, hey, I'm working on this film, I'm working on this new zine, you know what I mean? And these are all things that you're genuinely passionate about, not just the format, but the content, and the context. And so with that, I want to ask you about the statement that you made that's currently on the homepage of your site. We talked about this before these statements were made because we both felt like, do we have to do this? And then we both ended up making these statements.
Yeah.
I've seen the response to your statement, which was very, very strong. Just so I'm providing proper context for listeners and viewers, this is a statement as Black leaders, and for Marquise, you talked about being a Black designer in a world that there just maybe aren't as many Black designers as there should be, right?
Right.
And what does that mean? You're talking about the design of cities and what happens when Black people aren't part of the process of designing cities, right?
Absolutely.
Can you, I don't want to ask you to paraphrase, but maybe share the spirit of that.
Definitely. I mean, I think the core of it, and hopefully, some of your listeners can relate that love music, and being in Nashville, I'm sure there's a lot to love music, but just imagine if there were no Black blues musicians, right? What would music sound like? What if Coltrane and Miles Davis weren't allowed to play music? What would music sound like? What would Nashville be without any Black people being a part of the music scene, that we were never able to pick up an instrument? What would that sound like? Well, what that sounds like is what you see in design. That's the problem. is that design isn't just for me to have a job. It's for me to also make design better with my lived experience and the lived experience of you and every other person that is not involved. And so we take for granted when we listen to music that it's just beautiful music. When I come to Nashville, I'm not someone that maybe listens to that type of music or what you call country music, because in Nashville, it's just music, mm-hmm. which is what I love about Nashville. It's just music, it's just good music. Mm-hmm. And I don't care what it sounds like. When you see someone that's belting out their soul, you can feel it. You can see, I can hear the Billie Holiday mm-hmm. in their voice mm-hmm. when they're standing on the street corner or any other bar, because they've been influenced by her.
Right.
And so when you look at design and you don't see my face, there's a missing element and there's a missing opportunity. And are we really doing design? I really challenge that notion. Are we fully doing design the way design is supposed to be? Are cities designed the way they are? I mean, the same thing with women. You look at the buildings and the masculine form that the cities have taken. And so I always say there's something missing, and it's not just for me, it's for all of us. And the work that I'm passionate about is this ideal of the me for us versus the us for me. Mm. I think too many times in this country, we think about, you know, my individual rights is supported by this idea of us, and it's only for me.
Right.
I was raised that what I do is for us.
Right.
At the end of the day, I'm working towards the us, not the me. And that's every project that I touch, everything I'm doing. It's about how do we get there.
Man, that was more powerful than I was expecting. Man, let's talk about something fun. So, you know, You always sort of have something new in the works, and you've got this new magazine journal called Deem. Let's talk about this. Like, what was the genesis of it? Why did you bring it into the world? And it's a collaboration, right?
Yeah, so the genesis is that I had a different magazine that I was a part of called Makeshift Magazine years ago, and I loved it. It was such a fun experience. And I actually grew up, my dad, we had a family newspaper in my hometown called the Mansfield Star after Frederick Douglass's Star, North Star. And so I grew up having a newspaper, a family newspaper. Wow. So it was the black newspaper. So I grew up going to the printing and press and seeing all that. And so fast forward to now, I just felt that not only did I want to do something to allow us to create content, I also wanted to create something that was tactile, that showed evidence of who we are and what we do. I think the digital form and all of this is great.
Yeah.
But I think there's something powerful when I get a picture from someone that was just at the Tate in London, and they see the evidence of the work that we're doing because they carry our magazine. That you can go into a store and you can see it. And I think that there's something there for me that I wanted to express to show evidence, because this world, I mean, Black Lives Matter really is what they're saying is, hey, I matter, I exist. It's really what these young kids are saying. I exist. And therefore, if I exist, I should matter. Because lots of people want to see us as invisible, as if we're not there. And we're only visible when they need us to be visible, and then not always the evidence of our greatness in the visibility of us. Mm. And that's what the designing this magazine and having it. And it's a cross-cultural magazine. We have people all over the world in the magazine. And It's not necessarily a Black magazine, but because it is founded by myself and two other individuals who are Black, it's a different narrative that no one has ever seen. And stories about us in our neighborhoods around the world, whether it's in Japan or in South America, a platform that allows those stories to not just be short, choppy sound bites, but that it's a journal, it's evidence. You get this journal and you can read it for years to come.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Where did the name come from?
Oh man, we went through so many iterations of a name, but for us, this idea of deem it so.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To believe and to deem it so. And that's what you and I do every day. Like we're magicians. Like you and I are, I'm sitting right now inside your vision. You thought about doing this and people are, well, how do you do this? Well, I thought about it and I did it and I made it so. You deemed it so. And right now I'm sitting inside of your imagination live.
It's powerful, man.
Yeah. It's fun.
That is so powerful. How are you, you know, and we talked about this right before we went on the air, and I think this is a good time to sort of bring that conversation back. You know, how are you living and existing in this moment where, as you said, you and I are used to managing our time, used to creating, used to sort of, you know, the alchemy of creativity and entrepreneurship and design. We're used to that, right? Yeah. And also, we were fortunate from a timing perspective that we were able to get, you know, decades of work and experience behind us. So our networks are strong. Our ability to influence things in this time is good. Our financial situation is relatively stable, you know, relative to the rest of the country when 32% of GDP was shaved, right? How are you, you know, you are someone raised as an activist. You know what I mean? Like you're an artist and an activist and an entrepreneur, right? Like how are you in this moment? You've got a family, you've got businesses to maintain, but you also have this deep inner obligation, as you said, the me for us. How do you live in this moment, you know, when you see the protests happening and all these other things, man? How do you sort of feel about your role?
I think that my role and our role is there's a balance. So on one side of it, I know that the work that we're doing behind the scenes is really important and powerful. And not a lot of people understand that we're on a lot of different calls. I did receive a lot of calls and emails from other CEOs who were about to put out a statement and saying, hey, can you advise me? Can you give me some insights? What should we be thinking about? And I count that as a blessing and a privilege to be able to do that and really help to push people and call them out where they need to be called out. And I take that when I say put purpose to your privilege, right? I take that purpose with the privilege that I have seriously. Mm-hmm. And then there's a part of me as well that I took a road trip a few weeks ago and I drove to Detroit, to take care of a couple of things, but really I just wanted to see what was going on. And then I drove through Ohio where my family lives and I got to see my mom and brother and them. And then I drove down to Louisville, which is my dad is down there. And then I drove through Nashville real quickly. And then I drove back up and people was like, why would you do that? I'm like, I don't want to hide behind my privilege. Like I have the privilege of being able to be in a very safe environment, very clean, very sterile, that I don't have to step out. I do. I have everything that I need. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I want to make sure that, again, this idea of evidence, I want to see the evidence of the change that's happening. Mm-hmm. I want to see what's happening in cities like Detroit, where there are people taking advantage of this moment in negative ways.
So I'm glad you went there. I wanted to ask you, how was Detroit? You know, we hear reports.
We don't know. I mean, it's not the city that I know anymore. And you know, we talk about design and I also talk about aspects of things were designed a certain way. And in order for us to make change, we have to undesign those things. And unfortunately, I feel that Detroit is going the wrong way in regards to how certain people are able to participate in their own change, where you have a city that was predominantly a black city.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up when Washington, D.C. was chocolate city. Right. Detroit was another chocolate city.
Of course.
You know, I mean, it's part of Brooklyn, Fort Greene, like black, you know. And so those things are changing. They're going away. And with that removal, what's happening? And then you add in COVID and everything that's out. It's just accelerated. And I wanted to drive around and I wanted to see. And I did. I got on a bike and I just drove around the city, places where my uncle and places where they used to live. And I remember just hanging out. It's to God. Like these million-dollar condos are everywhere. And so I am very just mindful of the privilege that I have. And I want to make sure that if I'm talking to you or anyone else about the work that I'm doing, that I have evidence. Like I drove. I saw. And during the middle of COVID-19, I drove and I you know, I quarantined myself. I took the test. I'm negative. I'm good. I wore a mask. I was smart, but I documented. I took a lot of photos. I did speak with, you know, individuals at a distance just to check in, just to say, hey, what's going on? Because I want to make sure that when change happens, I want to see it. I want to be able to look you in your eyeballs and say, this is why I'm angry, because of 1, 2, 3. These are all the points.
Yeah.
And I saw them. And I saw them happening.
Yeah.
And it's important for us to do that.
This point of evidence is a new point. And it's interesting because this morning I was listening to Seth Godin's weekly podcast, Akimbo, mm-hmm. and today's episode was about AI, and it was about mm-hmm. GPT-3, and mm-hmm. it was about how it's going to get harder to tell online what's real. And so I think everything mm-hmm. you're saying has probably a stronger point than even we're making right now,
yeah.
that in yeah. this world where we're being separated and we're being pushed into digital modes, and mm-hmm. it's very easy to manipulate. You know, if anyone hasn't seen The Great Hack on Netflix, go see it. So you can, yeah. you know, see about Cambridge Analytica and
yeah.
how
yeah.
how people oh, are manipulated absolutely. With this digital technology. You know, you're what you're saying about a physical journal that you can hold, right?
Yes.
Going and laying eyes on people face to face, seeing, speaking, and tying that to evidence.
That's right.
That is a powerful paradigm right yeah. now that, man, we're not tracking very well. No. We're really not tracking. And I'm only bringing it up because in the context of everything else that is happening, a pandemic plus AI,
yeah. right?
Evidence yeah. is going to be more important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I am driving more and more to understand what does that evidence mean for me and the work that we do as designers, and our responsibility to make sure that we're building that evidence as a collaborative and including people from all walks of life. That's what's important. Because they need to see. You think about what this country has done to our history. They basically wiped out the history
totally.
Of what happened.
Totally.
So there's no evidence.
I know.
That we were, there's like questionable evidence. Were we really slaves?
I know.
Like the people are really questioning, like, did it really happen?
I know. It's legitimately an open right. debate. I mean, it's not right. really legitimate, but like, it's a debate.
It's a debate, which is ridiculous. Which is ridiculous.
Right.
Why? Because we weren't able to continue to hold on to the evidence to show people over and over and over again what it means to have gone through the things that we've gone through. And so my work is a part of that underline of my work that I do is constantly working within communities to make sure communities have voices. And the part of that voice is to make sure that there's evidence that they were there, that there was culture. Don't act like there was no culture before. Like you go to Bed-Stuy and people are like, oh yeah, we're bringing in, like what there right. wasn't?
Right.
What are you talking about? you know, like I'm starved. They caught two couple coffee shops and some yoga studio isn't culture. And I'm just keeping it real, right? And don't act like there wasn't culture there before. But it's always difficult for anyone to respect the evidence of our culture in the work we do. And so that's a big part of what's important for my work.
Man, this was so powerful. Just always good for me to get a chance to catch up with you, man. But I have to say, like, I'm leaving this conversation with a set of new things to really think about. This concept of evidence is that's a big one. That's a yeah. big one. And I told you before the show, I need to go and purchase a copy of Diem. I'm going to do that right when yeah. we're done here. Because yeah. this concept of evidence is, man, this is important.
Yes, it is.
This
it
is important. Really is. Man, thank you for the work that you do. Is there anything,
absolutely.
Anything you want to share before we get out of here? I'm going to promote all your stuff, but like,
No, man. Just a shout out to Real Friendships and shout out to the real evidence of our friendship. And I really appreciate what you do. And, you know, the people that are connected with you, thank you always for sharing and being just the most amazing host whenever I'm in town. And so keep doing what you're doing. Love your work. And anytime I can help out, please let me know. And,
thank you, brother. Thank you so much, man. Yeah. My man Marquise, follow him online, Open Box NYC, Deem Journal, deemjournal.com, opnbx.com. That's where you can follow the, it's like a rabbit hole, y'all. I'm just telling you, like, you know what I'm saying? It's like you start digging in and you're like, oh my God, this is incredible. And there is just something magnificent about seeing this, you know, I'll just say it like this, beautiful black man leading a design firm. So like, just like go spend some time on the site and just like, Just let it sink in. Let the imagery of it, you know what I'm saying? Like, change what you think is possible in the world. Create and orchestrate the book. Y'all know it's out there. Go grab it. The podcast, Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe, everywhere that you get your podcasts. You can follow me online at Marcus Whitney. And that is it. I will see you guys tomorrow with another episode of Marcus Whitney Live. Until then, let's build the new normal. Peace.
Thank you for tuning in to Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.